I'm not going to talk so much about this record, but it's actually, like I said already earlier, this record is somewhat of an illustration of what I will talk about. And that's, of course, noise. And I think, of course, noise in the colloquial understanding, of course, has a lot of ambiguity. In that sense, we use it to indicate unwanted sound or loud sounds or distant chatter, these kind of things. And I think this is also not for nothing, because also in the scientific discourse, there's a lot of ambiguity about noise, although this is somewhat more strategic. And we will look at this, where this actually comes from. And we do this by looking in two directions. On the one hand, I see a kind of information theoretic perspective of what noise is, and this comes from the thermodynamic history. And this is what I call the probable of noise, and we also look at the more kind of concrete implementation or the metaphorical value of noise, which I called the possible. And we start with the form, with the first one, and also with this one we will look at two significant moments in time, and with two characters. The one is the first one is Ludwig Boltzmann. Ludwig Boltzmann was a famous Austrian physicist, philosopher. And the second one, we look at Claude Shannon. And Claude Shannon was a mathematician that published in 1948 the paper Mathematical Theory of Communication. And this is, you could consider, the inauguration of information theory as we know it today. But I will give you an interlude, this, with a short excerpt of the book by Inigo Wilkins, a theorist on noise, but actually a cultural theorist, that has a forthcoming book coming out in next March. Yeah, it's called Irreversible Noise. But I got my hands already on the manuscript. So I will read, as a kind of interlude, a passage from this book. And it starts, thermodynamic entropy, or Boltzmann entropy, is a statistical measure of the disorder of a system in terms of the number of microstates. And microstates are the atomic and molecular configuration a system can have, that a given microstate can take. So we distinguish here between a micro and a microstate. This measure is related to the quantity of energy the system makes available. Since at maximum entropy, the microscopic components are at equilibrium, and all differences in temperature, density, or pressure have been equalized. This means that no energy can be extracted and no work can be done unless it is coupled with another system that introduces a difference. At equilibrium, the system is then homogeneous and the positions of its components are maximally random. It is important. So there is no pattern or order to their arrangement, and no information can be garnered from specifying the position or velocity of one of the atomic or molecular components. Information and order are thus inversely correlated in thermodynamics. A highly ordered system has low entropy and high information, and the more randomly arranged the components are, the higher the entropy. I will, of course, elaborate on this. But this actually introduces a kind of the paradigmatic shift where we start thinking from entropy as a concrete thing to an abstract one. Yeah. And this starts basically with Rudolf Clausius, which is kind of the godfather of thermodynamics, especially because he came up with the second law of thermodynamics, which basically says that entropy always increases. But he discovered, actually working on steam engines at that time, that he figured out, or at least just by empirical observation, that heat transfer only happens from a hot body to a cold body, and not the other way around. And this is what the second law of thermodynamics actually states. And this is an important very important law, kind of the thing, the law that still exists and still stays up top at this moment in the scientific discourse, because it says a kind of the irreversibility of the process of heat. And this, with this irreversibility, we have actually the introduction of the asymmetry of time, so that time has a direction, only goes forward, since heat cannot be transferred from a cold to a hot body. Nowhere else in scientific discourse exists this law that of the asymmetry of time. Don't have it in Newtonian gravity, because things can go up and down. Of course, not in quantum physics, because basically things only exist when you look at it. And also not in special relativity with Einstein, because basically the four dimensions of time and space can be curved in all directions. And at that time, Boltzmann was a strong believer of the atom. And there was no consensus yet that the atom exists. This was not really sedimented yet in scientific discourse. So, but Boltzmann was a strong believer of that microcosmos. And he thought, okay, if these atoms and billions of them, exist in a matter, this logic actually does not hold, that time is only going forward. And I will explain this actually. So he actually came up with a new direction of the thermodynamics, where it stops to be this physical empirical science, but actually enters the science of probabilities. And I will again here read an excerpt by Neger Steini of this book, Intelligent Experiment, where he basically talks about the two time lines of Boltzmann. He writes, "Thermodynamics is a thriller, but we all know how its plot unfolds. The film shows the expansion of a gas in a sealed bottle. There's an imaginary compartment with a trap door in the bottle. This is equilibrium state one. Inside this compartment, the gas is pressurized. Next, the film shows the imaginary door being opened. We can easily anticipate where the story is headed. The gas starts to spread far from equilibrium, and it finally fills the entire bottle. Equilibrium state two. The montage of this film is asymmetrically oriented. Once the trapdoor is released, we see gas filling the entire bottle, but never coming back to its original confinement in the imaginary compartment. And even if we watch the movie backwards, we can still tell what the plot is. This is the observed time asymmetry of an irreversible process. However, there is also a different montage, a subplot for this film. It shows the molecules of gas colliding with one another and freely moving in every direction. Whether we see this version on fast forward or in rewind, we can still not tell whether the gas is expanding in one direction or another. So this is the time symmetry of the underlying microscopic mechanical laws." And this is, in a way, where Boltzmann creates his contribution, because he basically says this has to do with our perception, so the perspective of the observer. That at the macro level, we can definitely see time moving forward, but on the other hand, on the micro level, it does not exist. And this basically means that this macro perspective that we have is basically the set of micro states that we cannot distinguish from each other. And this means basically that when you zoom in, this random distribution of atoms and molecules does not really attain any form. And this blurred vision is how the human perceptual capacity is basically adjusted and accustomed to this world. And this here we enter these two universes of the intelligible and the physical, intelligible and the sensible. So this blurred vision is basically how perception works and how do we have access to that. And this is also where I want to actually do a step backward before we can go forward. And this is also something where similar remarks were made actually in the early stage of the Enlightenment, where Leibniz actually introduced his idea of the monad. And Leibniz actually thought that these atomic units actually don't only exist on the material world, but also perception in that sense has a microcosmos. And he does not describe the world of atoms because it did not really exist, but he introduces a monad here that is neither material, but it's also not mental, so it's not a dualist concept. It's also not a monist concept, so in that sense, you know, he hovers in between Descartes and Spinoza. But he saw that it was a kind of intersubstantial account of reality. So that the monad itself contains a multitude of particular perceptions, but is always necessarily tied to a physical body. And the perceptual world and the physical world are entangled here. And he introduces here something of quite a remarkable historical document, where he talks about this complexity of perception that exists on the micro order, about when he thinks about the complex signal, complex physical signals of sound, in particular the hearing of the roaring ocean. And again, here I read a little excerpt because it emphasizes a lot better than I can do. And this excerpt is by Norman Sirocca. It is a German philosopher of science and physics in particular. But he states here, according to the expressive relation between physics and perception, the movements of every single drop of water, which taken together constitute the waves, must correspond to something on the level of perception. Since, on the perceptual level, the sound of the ocean does not consist of an innumerable amount of single and well-distinguished parts, but rather appears as a single noise or rush. Leibniz argues that the contribution of the single drops of water correspond to unnoticeable perceptions. I think in French it's called perceptions insensibles. And these unnoticeable perceptions, however, are not to be thought of in terms of an elementary ontological basis or as being the identifiable atoms of perception. According to Leibniz, there are no perceptual atoms, just as there are no ultimate or atomic particles or organic substances. You can even see that Leibniz is wrong sometimes. For Leibniz, the latter would be as implausible as assuming that a straight line really consists of separate points. Points like atomic substances and atomic perceptions are limit ideas, but never really constituents of a continuous quantity. Hence, according to Leibniz, every perception, just like every physical body, can be divided again and again and again into even more such perceptions without ever reaching a base. So, besides the indication of a kind of microcosmos, and I'm not speculating here that does exist, but I think nowadays this finds much more weight in scientific discourse, but especially in cognitive science. But what I extract from this text is that basically he describes here how perception is structured in a way. That is to say that it is a complex composition that consists on the lower level of unconscious one and that accumulate eventually to the upper levels of higher mental states. So, and it was not to say that they both exist, but he really referred as something that they have a structural resemblance between perceptual states and the physical manifestation of phenomena. And this is where this idea of the pre-established harmony comes from. So this relation between the perceptual world and the physical world. I think he called it the harmonia mundi, which is a kind of the psycho-physical parallelism. And of course, nowadays, these things are quite sensitive to talk about a kind of panpsychist view, but you can see that this is kind of the original base where these ideas actually coming from. And that's also why I said nowadays in cognitive science, for instance, there's a lot of emphasis on neural representations in relation to to the physical world, that certain phenomena have a kind of universalism in the brain, and it's basically on topological formations of neural maps. But he describes this, that these unnoticeable perceptions eventually accumulate to remarkable perceptions that give rise to higher mental states, but also, of course, including rational thoughts. And this is a kind of the program that Leibniz sets out. And he also distinguishes here between unnoticeable ones and unnoticed ones. And the unnoticed ones are only sensible when attended to. And only then they allow for a certain phenomenal differentiation. And he gives this example of the people living by a mill that eventually, you know, after kind of perceptual habituation, this sound of the mill will move to the background. And it's only when you attend it to it comes to the foreground. And I think this is quite a kind of crucial idea, how we can also relate this to noise or listening to noise. In that sense, that noise actually resists a kind of provocation to zoom into. It's only when it's modulated certain ways that we can extract some meaning from that. But I think, you know, it's also nice to think about that Leibniz basically describes that perception itself consists of this microcosmos, of this chaotic complexity of impenetrable elements, noise. So yeah, this was a bit of the shift between the physical and the perceptual, and now we will move to Shannon entropy. Like I said already, Claude Shannon, the American mathematician, that came up with a kind of new idea of entropy. And this markates quite an important moment in history, because it definitely involves a kind of pre and post Shannon era. And he worked for Bell, so the telephone company, and information theory was basically for him a kind of, he developed this to maximize the transmission efficiency of electronic communication networks. Shannon determined that this amount of information is actually a quantifier of uncertainty. And I think more formally, it says that the amount of information a signal conveyed could be measured by the reduction of uncertainty that it achieves in relation of the total possible states a system could attain. And in layman terms, it's basically a quantifier of uncertainty. So you could say that the message, for instance, encoded in binary language has an entropy rate of 2. So you could understand this as a yes or no question. So it takes, how many questions does it take to actually decipher a message? And like the Roman alphabet has 26 bits in that regard. So the entropy rate is much higher. But more importantly here, besides the idea of entropy and information, he also introduces not only a quantified concept of noise, but also where noise actually starts to take on different forms, different metaphorical values. Because noise, in that sense, is a disruption of the signal. It's a disruption of the order of a system, because it's somewhat the unwanted information of a transmission, in the transmission of an image. So it's the surplus of information that is present in the receiver, but not in the source. Because eventually, when we look at noise, doesn't matter from a micro perspective, there is a kind of ultimate uncertainty involved, because nothing can be distracted from it. There is no information present in noise. This is also why you see the sort of a spectrogram on the background. That white noise is a spectrum that contains all the frequencies in a maximally randomized order. And this is where you could understand as a kind of the ontogenetic structure of which all sound actually arises from. So it contains all the frequencies that we can hear. I mean, of course, you can recognize a philosophical concept in this. Yeah? The Leus virtual is basically also this space from where all possibilities arise. And again, here I will clarify this with a short excerpt of Inigo Wilkins' book, Irreversible Noise. A signal in which neither rules nor any pattern of redundancies are discoverable can convey no information, since all possibilities are equiprobable and no correlations are to be found. Any given signal would reduce no uncertainty. And this is basically the idea of ultimate noise. The equiprobability of static crackle equates with unpredictability and maximum freedom. But a series of totally random equiprobable signals is meaningless. No pattern or message is extractable from the disorder. There is none. At equilibrium, message variety is therefore a great but idle potential. Actual information is zero. And this leads to a fundamental tenet of information theory. A message with zero entropy rate is impossible, since it could communicate nothing but a repetition of the same. Without different signal possibilities, no uncertainty can be reduced and no information can be conveyed. So he basically described where information is involved, there is actually a possibility for meaning. Because in that sense, when information is involved, there exists a certain foreseeability, and a predictability and a probability, you could say. Because in that sense, you know, of prior states, future states can be anticipated or predicted. And I think this marks a kind of the ontological shift between noise and information, because in noise, there does not exist no past, no future, and only the length of the present, so to say. And this is also beautifully captured in this quote of that noise itself cannot carry any meaning apart from itself as meaning. And this comes from the book from Jacques Attali that wrote his book on noise, especially. You can have a look later. But you can understand here why also noise gains its political status or its metaphorical value, you could say. Because with this introduction of noise into a signal accounts for the disruption or the breakdown of order. Order, control, and expectation. And this is basically kind of the end of determinacy. So the only thing is left is that only thing is left when you have this, when there is no potential for meaning, the only thing that you can do basically is yourself, you immerse in this noise. Eh? Immerse in the uncertainty that is imposed by noise. And this is kind of the crisis of the intelligible that you could say, where aesthetics only becomes essential. And this is also referring again back to this ontogenetic structure of white noise. I think here we make also the shift where concrete noise basically comes in, especially how noise gained this political and cultural value in the 70s, so 60s and 70s. And I would argue, you know, this was only possible with Shannon's conception of noise as a disruptor of this order. Eh? Because this was also not present in the futurists with Rousselot, for instance. Because basically what happens here is that they try to overstaticize what noise was. That you had to indulge yourself in the noise of the capitalist society in order to gain a new perceptual capacity. And I don't think this is the right way to look at noise. And also this, the counter-hegemonic potential of noise, which was articulated by a lot of thinkers at that time, and maybe they were not all very conscious of this fact, but was only possible by this explanation of Shannon, more or less, about that noise as this disruption of a signal that comes in. Because basically you have this interference that is present in a in a channel between sender and receiver, and that obscures the intended order, but it preserves the subjectivity of disturbance. And I think this was an essential understanding of that. So again, here I think there's a kind of crucial part that this dialectic between culture and science is very much necessary in order to generate our political momentums, but also appropriate certain scientific concepts. And even in Jacques Attali's book, although far apart of the scientific understanding of noise, it's all over, and it's very much present. Because he actually, the reason why he introduced noise was basically because he saw that the political organization of the, that politics and that's an, or the superstructure had a sort of prospective value, that the political organization of the 20th century, as he called it, was actually already present in the political thought of the 19th, but more importantly, that it was the political thought in that sense was already present, although in embryonic form, in the music of the 18th, as he said it. So he also thought that besides a superstructure has a prospective value, it's also music that has this prospective value. But of course, his book is more about how music is basically embedded or appropriated in this techno-rationalization of society. And he sees noise as actually a disruptor of that prospective value in order to gain a certain new status. And I think nowadays, you know, this actually does not exist anymore, this concept of noise. Because I think, if we think about noise nowadays, that especially under the spell of what we call cognitive capitalism or surveillance capitalism, that that disruption of noise is actually superfluous. It doesn't exist anymore, because these models that we have and the predictive capacity is quite robust. So in that sense, noise, I would rather argue the opposite in that case, that actually that big apparatus, what we call also the technological stack, needs actually noise to perform better and to optimize its prediction. So I think here we get a shift of the understanding of what noise means, basically. And I think now what you also have different concepts arising, like for instance the incomputable, which could be a kind of the counterpart or the extension of what noise meant in that time.